It's not hopeless, Jake said. It's not a good draw, but not completely hopeless. I bet Lanier and his boys are smiling right now. Portia said, I don't understand you guys. Why is it always black versus white? I looked at those people, those faces, and I didn't see a bunch of hardcore racists who will burn the will and give everything to the other side. I saw some reasonable people out there. And some unreasonable ones, Harry Rex said. I agree with Portia, but we're a long way from the final 12. Let's save the bickering for later. After the recess, the lawyers were allowed to move their chairs around to the other sides of their tables so they could stare at the panel while the panel stared right back. Judge Attlee assumed the bench without the ritual of please rise for the court and began with a concise statement of the case. He said he expected the trial to last 3 or 4 days and that he certainly planned to be finished by Friday afternoon. He introduced the lawyers, all of them, but not the paralegals. Jake was alone, facing an army. Judge Attlee explained that he would cover a few areas that had to be discussed, then he would allow the attorneys to question and probe. He began with health. Anyone sick, facing treatment, or unable to sit and listen for long periods of time? One lady stood and said her husband was in the hospital in Tupelo, and she needed to be there. You are excused, Judge Attlee said with great compassion, and she hustled out of the courtroom. Number 29, gone. Number 40 had a herniated disc that had flared up over the weekend, and he claimed to be in considerable pain. He was taking painkillers that made him quite drowsy. You are excused, Judge Attlee said. He seemed perfectly willing to excuse anyone with a legitimate concern, but this proved not to be the case. When he asked about conflicts with work, a gentleman wearing a coat and tie stood and said he simply could not be away from the office. He was a district manager for a company that made steel buildings and was clearly an executive taken with his own importance. He even hinted he might lose his job. Judge Attlee's lecture on civic responsibility lasted 5 minutes and scorched the gentleman. He ended with, If you lose your job, Mr. Crawford, let me know. I'll subpoena your boss, put him on the stand here, and, well, he'll have a bad day. Mr. Crawford sat down, thoroughly chastised and humiliated. There were no more efforts to skip jury duty on account of work. Judge Attlee then moved to the next issue on his checklist, prior jury service. Several said they had served before, 3 in state court and 2 in federal. Nothing about those experiences would alter their ability to deliberate in the case at hand. 9 people claimed to know Jake Brigance. 4 were former clients, and they were excused. 2 ladies attended the same church, but felt as though that fact would not influence their judgment. They were not excused. A distant relative was. Carla's schoolteacher friend said she knew Jake well and was too close for any objectivity. She was excused. The last was a high school pal from Caraway who admitted he hadn't seen Jake in 10 years. He was left on the panel, to be dealt with later. Each lawyer was introduced again with the same questions. No one knew Wade Lanier, Lester Chilcott, Zach Zeitler, or Joe Bradley Hunt. But then they were out-of-town lawyers. Judge Attlee said, Now, moving along, the last will and testament in question was written by a man named Seth Hubbard, now deceased, of course. Did any of you know him personally? 2 hands were timidly lifted. A man stood and said he had grown up in the Palmyra area of the county and had known Seth when they were quite a bit younger. How old are you, sir? Judge Attlee asked.
69.
You know you can claim an exemption from service if you're above the age of 65, right?
Yes, sir. But I don't have to, do I?
Oh, no. If you want to serve, that's admirable. Thank you. A woman stood and said she had once worked at a lumberyard owned by Seth Hubbard, but it would not be a problem. Judge Atlee gave the names of Seth's two wives and asked if anyone knew them. A woman said her older sister had been friends with the first wife, but that had been a long time ago. Herschel Hubbard and Ramona Hubbard Defoe were asked to stand. They smiled awkwardly at the judge and the jurors, then sat down. Methodically, Judge Atlee asked the panel if anyone knew them. A few hands went up, all belonging to old classmates from Clanton High. Judge Atlee asked each one a series of questions. All claimed to know little about the case and to be unaffected by what little knowledge they possessed. Tedium set in as Judge Atlee went through page after page of questions. By noon, 12 of the 50 had been dismissed, all of them white. Of the 38 remaining, 11 were black, not a single one of whom had lifted a hand. During the lunch recess, the lawyers met in tense groups and debated who was acceptable and who had to be cut. They ignored their cold sandwiches while they argued over body language and facial expressions. In Jake's office, the mood was lighter because the panel was darker. In the main conference room over at the Sullivan firm, the mood was heavier because the blacks were sandbagging. Of the 11 remaining, not one admitted to knowing Letty Lang. Impossible in such a small county. There was obviously a conspiracy of some nature at work. Their expert consultant, Myron Pankey, had watched several of them closely during the questioning and had no doubt that they were trying their best to get on the jury. But Myron was from Cleveland and knew little about Southern blacks. Wade Lanier, though, was unimpressed. He had tried more cases in Mississippi than the rest of the lawyers combined, and he was not concerned about the remaining 38 members of the pool. In almost every trial, he hired consultants to dig into the backgrounds of the jurors, but once he saw them in the flesh, he knew he could read them, and though he did not say so, he liked what he had seen that morning. Lanier still had two great secrets up his sleeve, the handwritten will of Irene Pickering and the testimony of Julina Kidd. To his knowledge, Jake had no idea what was coming. If Lanier managed to successfully detonate these two bombs in open court, he might just walk away with a unanimous verdict. After considerable negotiating, Fritz Pickering had agreed to testify for $7,500. Julina Kidd had jumped at the offer of only $5,000. Neither Fritz nor Julina had spoken to anyone on the other side, so Lanier was confident his ambushes would work. So far, his firm had either spent or committed to spending just over $85,000 in litigation expenses, monies the clients were ultimately responsible for. The cost of the case was rarely discussed, though it was always in their thoughts. While the clients were troubled by rising expenses, Wade Lanier understood the economic realities of big-time litigation. 2 years earlier, his firm had spent $200,000 on a product liability case and lost. You roll the dice, and sometimes you lose. Wade Lanier, though, was not contemplating a loss in the Seth Hubbard case. Nevin Dark settled into a booth at the coffee shop with three of his new friends and ordered iced tea from Dell. All four wore white lapel buttons with the word juror in bold blue letters, as if they were now officially off limits and beyond approach. Dell had seen the same buttons 100 times and knew she should listen hard but ask no questions and offer no opinions. The 38 remaining jurors had been warned by Judge Atlee not to discuss the case. Since none of the four at Nevin's table had ever met, they chatted about themselves for a few minutes while looking over the menus. Fran Decker was a retired schoolteacher from Lake Village, 10 miles south of Clanton. Charles Osier sold farm tractors for a company out of Tupelo and lived near the lake. Debbie Lacker lived in downtown Palmyra, population 350, but had never met Seth Hubbard. Since they couldn't talk about the case, they talked about the judge, the courtroom, and the lawyers. Dell listened hard, but gleaned nothing from their lunch conversation, at least nothing she could report to Jake in the event he stopped by later for the gossip. At 1:15, they paid their separate checks and returned to the courtroom. At 1:30, when all 38 were accounted for, Judge Attlee appeared from the rear and said, "Good afternoon." He went on to explain that he would now continue with the selection of the jury, and he planned to do so in a manner that was somewhat unusual. Each juror would be asked to step into his chambers to be quizzed by the lawyers in private. Jake had made this request because he assumed the jurors, as a group, knew more about the case than they were willing to admit. By grilling them in private, he was confident he could elicit more thorough responses. Wade Lanier did not object. Judge Attlee said, "Mr. Nevin Dark, would you join us in my chambers, please?" A bailiff showed him the way, and Nevin nervously walked past the bench, through a door, down a short hallway, and into a rather small room where everyone was waiting. A court reporter sat ready to transcribe every word. Judge Attlee occupied one end of the table, and the lawyers crowded around the rest of it.
"Please remember that you're under oath, Mr. Dark," Judge Attlee said.
"Of course." Jake Brigance flashed him an earnest smile and said, "Some of these questions might be kind of personal, Mr. Dark, and if you don't want to answer them, that's fine. Do you understand?"
"I do."
"Do you currently have a last will and testament?"
"I do."
"Who prepared it?"
"Barney Suggs, a lawyer in Caraway."
"And your wife?"
"Yes, we signed them at the same time, in Mr. Suggs' office about 3 years ago."
Without asking the specifics of their wills, Jake nibbled around the edges of the will-making process. What prompted them to prepare their wills? Do their children know what's in the wills? How often have they changed their wills? Did they name each other as executor of their wills? Have they ever inherited anything from another will? Did he, Nevin Dark, believe a person should have the right to leave his property to anyone, to a non-family member, to charity, to a friend or employee, to cut out family members who may have fallen out of favor? Had either Mr. Dark or his wife ever considered changing their wills to exclude a person currently named as a beneficiary? And so on. When Jake finished, Wade Lanier asked a series of questions about drugs and painkillers. Nevin Dark said he had used them only sparingly, but his wife was a breast cancer survivor and at one time had relied on some strong medications for pain. He could not remember their names. Lanier showed genuine concern for this woman he had never met and poked and prodded enough to convey the message that strong painkillers taken by very sick people often cause a lapse in rational thinking. The seed was skillfully planted. Judge Attlee was watching the clock, and after 10 minutes, he called time. Nevin returned to the courtroom, where everyone stared at him. Juror number 2, Tracy McMillan, was waiting in a chair by the bench and was quickly led to the back room, where she faced the same questioning. Boredom hit hard, and many of the spectators left. Some of the jurors napped while others read and reread newspapers and magazines. Bailiffs yawned and gazed from the large plate glass windows overlooking the courthouse lawn. One prospective juror replaced the next in a steady parade to Judge Attlee's chambers. Most disappeared for the full 10 minutes, but a few were finished in less time. When juror number 11 emerged from her interrogation, she passed the benches and headed for the door, excused from service for reasons those sitting in the courtroom would never know. Letty and Phaedra left for a long break. As they walked down the aisle toward the double doors, they were careful to avoid glancing at the Hubbard clan, bunched together on the back row. It was almost 6:30 when juror number 38 left chambers and returned to the courtroom. Judge Attlee, showing remarkable energy, rubbed his hands together and said,
"Gentlemen, let's finish this job now so we can start fresh with the opening statements in the morning. Agreed?"
Jake said, "Judge, I'd like to renew my motion for a change of venue. Now that we've interviewed the first 38 jurors, it is apparent that as a whole, this panel knows far too much about this case. Almost every juror was willing to admit he or she had heard something about it. This is quite unusual in a civil case."
"Quite the contrary, Jake," Judge Attlee said. "I thought they answered the questions well. Sure, they've heard about the case, but almost all of them claim to be able to keep an open mind."
"I agree, Judge," Wade Lanier said. "With a few exceptions, I'm impressed with the panel."
"Motion is overruled, Jake."
"No surprise," Jake mumbled just loud enough to be heard.
"Now, can we pick our jury?"
"I'm ready," Jake said.
"Let's go," replied Wade Lanier.
"Very well. I'm dismissing jurors number 3, 4, 7, 9, 15, 18, and 24 for cause. Any discussion?"
Slowly, Lanier said, "Yes, Your Honor. Why number 15?
"He said he knew the Roston family and was deeply saddened by the deaths of their 2 sons. I suspect he holds a grudge against anyone with the last name of Lang."
"He said he did not, Your Honor," Lanier argued.
"Of course that's what he said. I just don't believe him. He's excused for cause. Anyone else?"
Jake shook his head no. Lanier was angry, but said nothing. Judge Attlee pressed on.
"Each side has 4 peremptory challenges. Mr. Brigance, you must present the first 12.
Jake nervously scanned his notes, then slowly said,
"Okay. We'll take numbers 1, 2, 5, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 17, 19, 21, and 22.
There was a long pause as everyone in the room looked at their charts and made notes. Finally, Judge Attlee said,
"So you struck 6, 13, 20, and 23, correct?"
"That's right."
"Are you ready, Mr. Lanier?"
"Just a second, Judge," Lanier said as he huddled with Lester Chilcott.
They whispered for a while, obviously in disagreement. Jake listened hard but could not decipher anything. He kept his eyes on his notes, on his chosen 12, knowing he could not keep them all.
"Gentlemen,"
Judge Attlee said.
"Yes, sir," Lanier said slowly. "We'll strike numbers 5, 16, 25, and 27.
The air left the room again as every lawyer and the judge struck names from makeshift charts and moved the higher numbers up the ladder. Judge Attlee said,
"So, it looks like our jury will consist of numbers 1, 2, 8, 10, 12, 14, 17, 19, 21, 22, 26, and 28. Does everyone concur?"
The lawyers shook their heads in agreement, without taking their eyes from their legal pads. 10 whites, 2 blacks, 8 women, 4 men. Half had wills, half did not. Three had college degrees. Seven finished high school. Two did not. Median age of 49, with two women in their 20s. A pleasant surprise for Jake. Overall, he was pleased. On the other side of the table, Wade Lanier was too. The truth was that Judge Attlee did a fine job of eliminating those who might possibly begin deliberations with preconceived notions or prejudices. On paper, it appeared as if the extremists were gone, and the trial was left in the hands of 12 people who appeared to be open-minded.
"Let's pick a couple of alternates," His Honor said.
At 7 p.m., the new jurors gathered in the jury room and got themselves organized, according to Judge Attlee's instructions. Because he had been the first one selected, the first name called, the first to be seated, and because he gave every indication of being an amicable type with an easy smile and kind word to all, Mr. Nevin Dark was elected foreman of the jury. It had been a very long day, but an exciting one. As he drove home, he found himself eager to chat with his wife over a late dinner and tell her everything. Judge Attlee had warned them against discussing the case with each other, but he didn't say a word about spouses. Chapter 40. Lucian shuffled the deck and deftly dealt 10 cards to Lonnie and the same to himself. As usual now, Lonnie slowly lifted his cards from the top of the folding table and took forever arranging them in his preferred order. His hands and words were slow, but his mind seemed to be clicking right along. He was up 30 points in this their fifth game of gin rummy. He had won 3 of the first 4. He was wearing a saggy hospital gown and an IV hung just over his head. A nicer nurse had given him permission to leave his bed and play cards in front of the window, but only after Lonnie had raised his voice. He was sick and tired of the hospital and wanted to leave. But then, he really had no place to go. Only the city jail, where the food was even worse and the cops were waiting with questions. In fact, they were waiting just outside his door now. 30 kilos of cocaine will always create problems. His new pal Lucian, who said he was a lawyer, had guaranteed him the evidence would be tossed on a motion to suppress. The cops had no probable cause to enter Lonnie's room at the flophouse. Just because a man gets hurt in a bar fight does not give the police the right to rummage through his locked living quarters.
"It's a slam dunk," Lucian had promised. "Any half-assed criminal lawyer gets the coke thrown out. You'll walk."
They had talked about Seth Hubbard, with Lucian throwing in all the facts, gossip, fabrications, speculations, and rumors that had been roaring through Clanton during the past 6 months. Lonnie claimed to be only mildly curious, but he seemed to enjoy listening. Lucian did not mention the handwritten will, nor the black housekeeper. Expansively, he recounted Seth's amazing 10-year run from a man broken by his second nasty divorce to a high-flying risk-taker who parlayed his own mortgaged property into a fortune. He described Seth's zeal for secrecy, his offshore bank accounts, and maze of corporations. He told the amazing historical anecdote of Seth's father, Cleon, hiring Lucian's grandfather, Robert E. Lee Wilbanks, to handle a land dispute in 1928, and they lost. Lucian talked almost nonstop in an effort to gain Lonnie's trust, to convince him there was no harm in telling secrets from the past. If Lucian could open up so completely, then Lonnie could too. On 2 occasions during the morning, Lucian had gently poked into the business of Lonnie knowing anything about Ansel, but neither punch had landed. Lonnie seemed to have no interest in that subject. They talked and played throughout the morning. By noon, Lonnie was fatigued and needed rest. The nurse enjoyed telling Lucian to leave. He did so, but was back 2 hours later to check on his new friend. Lonnie now wanted to play blackjack at a dime a hand. After half an hour or so, Lucian said,
I called Jake Brigance, the lawyer I work for in Mississippi, and I asked him to check out this Sylvester Ryans guy you mentioned. He found something.
Lonnie put his cards down and gave Lucian a curious look. Deliberately, he said, What?
Well, according to the land records in Ford County, Sylvester Ryans owned 80 acres of land in the northeast part of the county, land he had inherited from his father, a man named Solomon Ryans, who was born about the time the Civil War started. Though the records are not clear, there's a good chance the Ryans family came to own the land just after the war, during Reconstruction, when freed slaves were able to obtain land with the help of carpetbaggers and federal governors and other scum that flooded our land back then. It looks as though this 80 acres was in dispute for some time. The Hubbard family owned another 80 acres that adjoined the Ryans' property, and evidently they contested this property. The lawsuit I mentioned this morning, the one filed in 1928 by Cleon Hubbard, was a dispute over the Ryans' property. My grandfather, who was the finest lawyer in the county and well-connected, lost the case for Cleon. I got to figure that if my grandfather lost the case, then the Ryans family must have had a pretty strong claim to the land. So Sylvester managed to hang on to his property for a few more years, but then he died in 1930. After he died, Cleon Hubbard obtained the land from Sylvester's widow.
Lonnie had picked up his cards, and he studied them without seeing them. He was listening and recalling images from another lifetime.
Pretty interesting, huh? Lucian said.
It was a long time ago, Lonnie said, grimacing as pain rippled through his skull. Lucian plowed ahead. With nothing to lose, he was not about to relax.
The strangest part of this entire story is that there is no record of Sylvester's death. There's not a single Ryans now living in Ford County, and it appears as though they all left about the time Cleon Hubbard got his hands on the property. They all vanished. Most fled to the north, to Chicago, where they found jobs, but this was not uncommon in the Depression. A lot of starving blacks fled the Deep South. According to Mr. Brigance, they found a distant relative over in Alabama, a man named Boaz Ryans, who claims that some white men took Sylvester and killed him.
What does this have to do with anything? Lonnie asked. Lucian stood and walked to the window where he gazed at a parking lot below. He debated telling the truth now, telling Lonnie about the will and Letty Lang and her ancestry, that she was almost certainly a Ryans instead of a Tabor, that her people were from Ford County and had once lived on the land owned by Sylvester, that it was highly probable Sylvester was in fact her grandfather. But he sat back down and said,
Nothing really. Just some old history involving my kinfolks, Seth Hubbard's, and maybe Sylvester Ryans.
There was a moment of silence in which neither man touched his cards. Neither made eye contact. As Lonnie seemed to drift away, Lucian jolted him with,
You knew Ansel, didn't you?
I did, Lonnie said.
Tell me about him. I need to find him, and quick.
What do you want to know about him?
Is he alive?
He is, yes.
Where is he right now?
Don't know.
When did you last see him?
A nurse entered chattering away about checking his vitals. He said he was tired, and so she helped him into his bed, arranged his IV, glared at Lucian, then checked Lonnie's blood pressure and pulse. He needs to rest, she said. Lonnie closed his eyes and said, "Don't go. Just turn down the lights." Lucian pulled a chair close to his bed and sat down. After the nurse left, he said,
"Tell me about Ansel."
With his eyes still closed and his voice almost a whisper, Lonnie began, "Well, Ansel has always been a man on the run. He left home when he was young and never went back. He hated home, hated his father especially. He fought in the war, got wounded, almost died. A head injury. And most folks think Ansel's always been a bit off upstairs. He loved the sea. Said he had been born so far away from it that it captivated him. He spent years on cargo ships and saw the world. All of it. You can't find a spot on the map that Ansel hasn't seen. Not a mountain, a port, a city, a famous site. Not a bar, a dance club, a whorehouse, you name it, and Ansel's been there. He hung out with rough characters, and from time to time fell into bad ways. Petty crime, then some not so petty. He had some near misses, once spent a week in a hospital in Sri Lanka with a knife wound. The knife wound was nothing compared with the infection he got in the hospital. He had lots of women, some of whom had lots of children. But Ansel was never one to stay in one place. Last he knew, some of those women were still looking for him, with their children. Others might be looking for him, too. Ansel has lived a crazy life, and he's always looked over his shoulder. When he said the word life, it came out wrong. Or perhaps it came out naturally. The long eye was much flatter than before, much like the flattened eyes so common in North Mississippi. Lucian had deliberately fallen back into a twangier version of speech in hopes that it might lure old Lonnie here into the same habit. Lonnie was from Mississippi, and they both knew it. He closed his eyes and seemed to sleep. Lucian stared at him for a few minutes, waiting. His breathing became heavier as he drifted away. His right hand fell to his side. The monitor showed a normal blood pressure and heartbeat. To stay awake, Lucian paced around the darkened room, waiting for a nurse to appear and shoo him away. He eased next to the bed, squeezed Lonnie's right wrist firmly, and said,
"Ansel. Ansel, Seth left behind a last will and testament that gives you $1 million.
The eyes came open, and Lucian repeated himself. The debate had raged for an hour, unabated, and tempers were on edge. In fact, the issue had been hotly discussed for a month with no shortage of opinions. It was almost 10 p.m., The conference table was littered with notes, files, books, and the remains of a bad takeout pizza they had devoured for dinner. Should the jury be told the value of Seth's estate? The only issue at trial was whether the handwritten will was valid. Nothing more, nothing less. Legally, technically, it didn't matter how big or how small the estate was. On one side of the table, the side being occupied by Harry Rex, the strong feeling was that the jury should not be told, because if the jurors knew that $24 million was in play and about to be given to Letty Lang, they would balk. They would naturally take a dim view of such a transfer of wealth outside the family. Such a sum was so unheard of, so shocking, that it was inconceivable that a lowly black housekeeper should walk away with it. Lucian, while absent, agreed with Harry Rex. Jake, though, felt otherwise. His first point was that the jurors probably had a hunch that a lot of money was on the table, though virtually all had denied such knowledge during the selection process. Look at the size of the fight. Look at the number of lawyers on deck. Everything about the case and the trial was evidence of big money. His second point was that full disclosure was the best policy. If the jurors felt as though Jake was trying to hide something, he would start the trial with an immediate loss of credibility. Every person in the courtroom wants to know what the brawl is about. Tell them. Lay it out. Withhold nothing. If they concealed the size of the estate, then the size of the estate would become a festering and unspoken issue. Portia went back and forth. Before the jury was seated, she was leaning in favor of a full disclosure. But after looking at the 10 white faces and only 2 black ones, she was struggling to believe they had any chance at all. After all the witnesses had testified, after all the lawyers had been silenced, after all the wise words had been uttered by Judge Attlee, could those 10 white people reach deep and find the courage to uphold Seth's last will? At the moment, fatigued and weary, she was doubtful. The phone rang and she answered it.
"It's Lucien," she said, handing it to Jake, who said, "Hello?"
From Alaska came the report.
"Got him, Jake. Our pal here is Ansel Hubbard, one and the same."
Jake exhaled and said,
"Well, I guess that's good news, Lucien."
He pulled the receiver away and said, "It's Ansel."
"What are you guys doing?" Lucien asked.
"Just prepping for tomorrow. Me, Portia, Harry Rex. You're missing the party."
"Do we have a jury?"
"Yes. 10 whites, 2 blacks. No real surprises. Tell me about Ansel."
"Pretty sick puppy. His head wound is infected and the doctors are concerned. Tons of meds, antibiotics, and painkillers. We played cards all day and talked about everything. He sort of comes and goes. I finally mentioned the will and told him his big brother left him $1 million. Got his attention, and he admitted who he is. Half an hour later, he had forgotten about it."
"Should I tell Judge Attlee?"
Harry Rex shook his head no.
"I don't think so," Lucien said. "The trial has started, and it won't be stopped for this. Ansel has nothing to add. He damn sure can't get there, what with a cracked skull and the cocaine thing waiting just outside his door. Poor guy will probably serve some time eventually. The cops seem determined."
"Did you guys climb the family trees?"
"Yes, quite a bit. But long before he came clean. I laid out the history of the Hubbard and Ryans families, with emphasis on the mystery of Sylvester. But he had little interest. I'll try again tomorrow. I'm thinking about leaving tomorrow afternoon. I really want to see some of the trial. I'm sure you'll have it all screwed up by the time I get there."
"No doubt, Lucien," Jake said, and hung up a moment later. He relayed the conversation to Portia and Harry Rex, who, though intrigued by it, had other matters at hand. The fact that Ansel Hubbard was alive and living in Alaska would mean nothing in the courtroom. The phone rang again and Jake grabbed it. Willie Traynor said,
"Say, Jake, just for your information, there's a guy on the jury who shouldn't be there."
"It's probably too late, but I'm listening." "He's on the back row. Name's Doley. Frank Doley." Jake had seen Willie taking notes throughout the day.
"Okay, so what's Frank up to?" Jake asked.
"He has a distant cousin who lives in Memphis. 6 or 7 years ago, this cousin's 15-year-old daughter was snatched by some black punks outside a mall in East Memphis. They kept her in a van for several hours. Terrible things happened. The girl survived but was too messed up to identify anyone. No one was ever arrested. 2 years later, the girl committed suicide.
a real tragedy.
Why are you telling me this now?
I didn't catch the name until an hour ago. I was in Memphis at the time, and I remembered some dolies from Ford County. You'd better get him bumped, Jay.
It's not that easy. In fact, it's impossible at this point. He was quizzed by the lawyers and the judge and gave all the right answers.
Frank Doley was 43 years old and owned a roofing company out near the lake. He claimed to know nothing about the Seth Hubbard matter and seemed perfectly open-minded.
Thanks for nothing, Willie.
Willie said, "Sorry, Jake, but it didn't register in court. I would have said something."
"It's okay. I'll deal with it somehow.
Other than Doley, what do you think of your jury?"
Jake was talking to a journalist, so he played it safe.
"A good panel," he said.
"Gotta run."
Harry Rex's response was,
"I was worried about that guy. Something wasn't right."
To which Jake shot back, "Well, I don't recall you saying anything at the time. It's always easy to call plays on Monday morning."
Testy.
Portia said, "He seemed eager to serve. I gave him an 8.
Jake said, "Well, we stuck with him. He gave all the right answers."
"Maybe you didn't ask the right questions,"
Harry Rex said as he took another swig of Bud Light.
"Thank you so much, Harry Rex. For your own future reference, during the jury selection process, lawyers are not normally allowed to ask questions like, 'Say, Mr. Doley, is it true your distant cousin was gang-raped by a bunch of black thugs in Memphis?' And the reason for this prohibition is that the lawyers generally don't know about such horrible crimes."
"I'm going home."
Another swig. "Let's all go home," Portia said. "We're not accomplishing much." It was almost 10:30 when they turned out the lights. Jake walked around the square to clear his head. At the Sullivan firm, lights were still on. Wade Lanier and his team were still in there, still working. Chapter 41. In his defense of Carl Lee Haley, Jake's opening statement to the jury lasted only 14 minutes. Rufus Buckley had kicked things off with a 1.5-hour marathon that had put the jury to sleep, and Jake's concise follow-up had been well-received and much appreciated. The jury had listened to him and absorbed every word.
"Jurors are captives," Lucian always said, "so keep it short."
In the matter of the last will and testament of Henry Seth Hubbard, Jake was aiming for 10 minutes. He stepped to the podium, smiled to the fresh and eager faces, and began with, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, your job is not to give away Seth Hubbard's money. There's a lot of it, and all of it was earned by Seth Hubbard himself. Not by you, not by me, not by any of the lawyers in this courtroom. He took chances, borrowed heavily at times, ignored the advice of his trusted lieutenants, mortgaged his own house and land, made deals that looked bad on paper, borrowed even more, took risks that seemed outrageous, and in the end, when Seth Hubbard was told he was dying of lung cancer, he sold out. He cashed in his chips, paid off the banks, and counted his money. He won. He was right, and everybody else was wrong. You can't help but admire Seth Hubbard. I never met the man, but I wish I had. How much money? You will hear testimony from Mr. Quince Lundy, the gentleman sitting right here, and the court-appointed administrator of Seth Hubbard's estate, that the estate has a value of approximately $24 million. Jake was pacing slowly, and when he gave the amount, he stopped and looked at some of the faces. Almost every juror smiled.
"Go, Seth. Attaboy."
A couple were obviously shocked. Tracy McMillan, juror number two, looked at Jake with wide eyes, but the moment passed quickly. No one in Ford County could grasp a number like that. Now, if you think a man who put together a $24 million fortune in about 10 years knows what he's doing with his money, then you're right. Because Seth knew exactly what he was doing. The day before he hung himself, he went to his office, locked his door, sat down at his desk, and wrote a new will. A handwritten will. One perfectly legal, nice, and legible, easy to understand, not the least bit complicated or confusing. He knew he was going to commit suicide the following day, Sunday, October 2nd, and he was putting everything in order. He planned it all. He wrote a note to a man named Calvin Boggs, an employee, in which he explained he was taking his own life. You will see the original. He wrote detailed funeral and burial instructions. You will see the originals. And on that same Saturday, presumably at his office while he was writing his will, he wrote a letter to me and gave me specific instructions. Again, you will see the original. He planned it all. After he finished writing, he drove to Clanton, to the main post office, and mailed the letter to me, along with the will. He wanted me to receive the letter on Monday, because his funeral was on Tuesday at 4 p.m. at the Irish Road Christian Church. Details, folks. Seth took care of the details. He knew exactly what he was doing. He planned it all. Now, as I said, it's not your job to give away Seth's money or to decide who should get what or how much. However, it is your job to determine if Seth knew what he was doing. The legal term is testamentary capacity. To make a valid will, one that is handwritten on the back of a grocery bag or one typed by five secretaries in a big law office and signed before a notary public, one has to have testamentary capacity. It's a legal term that's easy to understand. It means you have to know what you're doing. And ladies and gentlemen, Seth Hubbard knew exactly what he was doing. He wasn't crazy. He wasn't delusional. He wasn't under the influence of painkillers or other meds. He was as mentally sound and sane as the 12 of you are right now. It might be argued that a man planning his own suicide cannot be of sound mind. You got to be crazy to kill yourself, right? Not always. Not necessarily. As jurors, you are expected to rely on your own experiences in life. Perhaps you've known someone, a close friend, or even a family member who came to the end of the road and chose his or her own final exit. Were they out of their minds? Perhaps, but probably not. Seth certainly was not. He knew exactly what he was doing. He had battled lung cancer for a year with several rounds of chemotherapy and radiation, all unsuccessful, and the tumors had finally metastasized to his ribs and spine. He was in terrible pain. At his last visit to his doctor, he was given less than a month to live. When you read what he wrote the day before he died, you'll be convinced that Seth Hubbard was in complete control of his life. As a prop, Jake was holding a legal pad, but he wasn't using it. He didn't need it. He walked back and forth before the jurors, making eye contact with every one of them, speaking slowly and clearly, as if they were sitting in his den and chatting about their favorite movies. But every word was written somewhere. Every sentence had been rehearsed. Every pause was calculated. The timing, cadence, rhythm, all memorized to near perfection. Even the busiest of trial lawyers spend only a fraction of their time in front of juries. These moments were rare, and Jake relished them. He was an actor on a stage, in the midst of a monologue he created, speaking words of wisdom to his chosen audience. His pulse was spiking, his stomach was flipping, his knees were weak. But those internal battles were all under control, and Jake calmly lectured his new friends. 5 minutes in, and he had not missed a word. 5 minutes to go, with the roughest part just ahead. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there is an unpleasant part of this story, and that's why we're all here. Seth Hubbard was survived by a son and a daughter and 4 grandchildren. In his will, he left them nothing. In language that is plain and clear, but also painful to read, Seth specifically excluded his family from inheriting under his will. The obvious question is, why? It is our natural tendency to ask, why would a man do this? However, it is not your responsibility to ask that question. Seth did what he did for reasons known only to him. Again, he made the money. It all belonged to him. He could have given every penny to the Red Cross or to some slick televangelist or to the Communist Party. That's his business, not yours, not mine, not this court's. Instead of leaving his money to his family, Seth left 5% to his church, 5% to a long-lost brother, and the remaining 90% was given to a woman by the name of Letty Lang. Ms. Lang is sitting right here between me and Mr. Lundy. She worked for Seth Hubbard for 3 years as his housekeeper, his cook, and sometimes his nurse. Again, the obvious question is, why? Why did Seth cut out his family and leave almost everything to a woman he had known for such a short period of time? Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, that is the greatest question I've ever confronted as a lawyer. That question has been asked by me, by the other lawyers, by the Hubbard family, by Letty Lang herself, by friends and neighbors, and by virtually everyone in this county who's heard the story. Why? The truth is that we'll never know. Only Seth knew, and he's no longer with us. The truth, folks, is that it's none of our business. We, the lawyers, the judge, you, the jurors, are not supposed to concern ourselves with why Seth did what he did. Your job, as I've said, is to decide only one important issue, and that is simply this. At the time Seth wrote his last will, was he thinking clearly, and did he know what he was doing? He was, and he did. The evidence will be clear and convincing. Jake paused and picked up a glass of water. He took a quick sip, and as he did so, he scanned at the crowded courtroom. On the second row, Harry Rex stared at him. He nodded quickly. "You're doing fine so far. You have their attention. Wrap it up." Jake returned to the podium, glanced at his notes, and continued. "Now, with this much money on the line, we can expect things to get somewhat tense over the next few days. The family of Seth Hubbard is contesting the handwritten will, and they are not to be faulted for this. They sincerely believe the money should have been given to them, and they've hired a bunch of good lawyers to attack the handwritten will. They claim that Seth lacked testamentary capacity. They claim his judgment was clouded. They claim he was unduly influenced by Letty Lang. The term undue influence is a legal term and will be crucial in this case. They will attempt to convince you that Letty Lang used her position as a caregiver to become intimate with Seth Hubbard. Intimacy can mean many things. She cared for Seth, at times bathed him, changed his clothes, cleaned up behind him, did all the things that caregivers are supposed to do in those delicate and awful situations. Seth was a dying old man, hit with a debilitating and deadly cancer that left him weak and feeble. Jake turned and looked at Wade Lanier and the gang of lawyers at the other table. They will imply a lot, ladies and gentlemen, but they can prove nothing. There were no physical relations between Seth Hubbard and Letty Lang, only hints and suggestions and implications, but no proof because it never happened. Jake tossed his legal pad on his table and wrapped it up. This will be a short trial with a lot of witnesses. As in every trial, the issues at times might become confusing. This is often done on purpose by the lawyers, but don't be led astray. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, it's not your job to distribute Seth Hubbard's money. It's your job to determine if he knew what he was doing when he wrote his last will. Nothing more, nothing less. Thank you. At Judge Attlee's heavy-handed direction, the contestants had agreed to streamline their opening and closing remarks by allowing Wade Lanier to handle them. He strode to the podium in a wrinkled blazer, a tie too short, and a shirt tail barely tucked in. The few patches of hair around his ears shot out in all directions. He gave the impression of a scatterbrained plotter who might forget to show up tomorrow. It was all an act to disarm the jury. Jake knew better. He began with, "Thank you, Mr. Brigance. I've been trying lawsuits for 30 years. And I've yet to meet a young lawyer with as much talent as Jake Brigance. You folks here in Ford County are lucky to have such a fine young lawyer among you. It's an honor to be here doing battle with him, and also to be in this grand old courtroom." He paused to look at his notes as Jake stewed over all the fake praise. When he wasn't in front of a jury, Lanier was smooth and articulate. Now, though, on stage, he was folksy, down-to-earth, and immensely likable. "Now, this is just an opening statement, and nothing I say or nothing Mr. Brigance just said is evidence. The evidence comes from only one place, and that's this witness chair right here. Lawyers sometimes get carried away and say things they cannot later prove at trial. And they also tend to leave out important facts the jury should know about. For example, Mr. Brigance did not mention the fact that when Seth Hubbard wrote his last will, the only person in the building with him was Letty Lang. It was a Saturday morning, and she never worked on Saturdays.
she went to his house, and from there she drove him in his nice new Cadillac over to his office. He unlocked it. They went in. She says she was there to clean his office, but she had never done this before. They were alone. For some 2 hours, they were alone in the offices of the Bering Lumber Company, Seth Hubbard's main headquarters. When they arrived there on that Saturday morning, Seth Hubbard had a last will and testament prepared a year earlier by a fine firm of lawyers in Tupelo, lawyers he had trusted for years. And that will gave almost everything to his 2 adult children and 4 grandchildren. A typical will, a standard will, a sensible will. The kind of will virtually every American signs at one time or another. 90% of all property that passes through wills passes to the family of the deceased. That's the way it should be. Lanier was now pacing too, his stocky body lumbering back and forth, bowed somewhat at the waist. But after spending 2 hours in his office that morning, alone with no one but Letty Lang, when he left, he had another will, one he had written himself, one cutting out his children and cutting out his grandchildren and leaving 90% of his fortune to his housekeeper. Does that sound reasonable, folks? Let's put things in perspective. Seth Hubbard had been battling cancer for a year. A terrible struggle. A fight he was losing, and he knew it. The closest person in the world to Seth Hubbard during his last days on this earth was Letty Lang. On good days, she cooked and cleaned and took care of his house and things. And on bad days, she fed him, bathed him, dressed him, cleaned up after him. She knew he was dying. It was no secret. She also knew he was rich. And she also knew his relationship with his adult children was somewhat strained. Lanier paused near the witness chair, spread his arms wide in mock disbelief, and asked loudly, "Are we to believe she was not thinking about money? Come on. Let's get realistic here. Ms. Lang will tell you herself that she had spent her career as a housekeeper, that her husband, Mr. Simeon Lang, who's now in jail, had a spotty work record and could not be depended on for a paycheck, and that she had raised 5 kids under difficult financial circumstances. Life was tough. There had never been a spare dime anywhere. Like a lot of folks, Letty Lang was broke. She'd always been broke. And as she watched her boss inch closer and closer to death, you know she was thinking about money. It's human nature. It's not her fault. I'm not suggesting she was evil or greedy. Who among us would not have been thinking about the money? And on that Saturday morning, last October, Letty drove her boss to his office, where they were alone for 2 hours. And while they were alone, one of the greatest fortunes in the history of this state changed hands. $24 million was transferred from the Hubbard family to a housekeeper Seth Hubbard had known for only 3 years. Brilliantly, Lanier paused as his last sentence rattled around the courtroom. Damn, he's good, Jake thought, glancing at the jury as if all was well. Frank Doley was glaring at him with a look that said, "I despise you."
Lanier lowered his voice and continued. We will attempt to prove Seth Hubbard was unduly influenced by Ms. Lang. The key to this case is the issue of undue influence, and there are several ways to prove it. One sign of undue influence is the making of a gift that is unusual or unreasonable. The gift Seth Hubbard made to Ms. Lang is grossly, unbelievably unusual and unreasonable. Forgive me. I can't think of the right adjectives to describe it. 90% of $24 million and nothing for his family? That's pretty unusual, folks. In my book, that's pretty unreasonable. That screams of undue influence. If he wanted to do something nice for his housekeeper, he could have given her $1 million. That's a pretty generous gift. $2 million. How about $5 million? Actually, in my humble opinion, anything over $1 million would be considered unusual and unreasonable given the brief nature of their relationship. Lanier stepped back to the podium and glanced at his notes. Then he looked at his watch. 8 minutes, and he was in no hurry. We will attempt to prove undue influence by discussing a prior will made by Seth Hubbard. This will was prepared by a leading law firm in Tupelo a year before Seth died, and it left about 95% of his estate to his family. It's a complicated will with a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo that only tax lawyers understand. I don't understand it, and we'll try not to bore you with it. The purpose of discussing this earlier will is to illustrate the point that Seth was not thinking clearly. The earlier will, because it was prepared by tax lawyers who knew their stuff and not by a man on the verge of hanging himself, takes full advantage of the IRS code. In doing so, it saves over $3 million in taxes. Under Mr. Hubbard's handwritten will, the IRS gets 51%, over $12 million. Under the earlier will, the IRS gets $9 million. Now, Mr. Brigance likes to say that Seth Hubbard knew exactly what he was doing. I doubt it. Think about it, folks. A man shrewd enough and clever enough to amass such a fortune in 10 years does not throw together a handwritten document that will cost his estate $3 million. That's absurd. That's unusual and unreasonable. With his elbows, he leaned on the podium and tapped his fingers together. He looked into the eyes of the jurors as they waited. He finally said, "Let me wrap things up here. And I must say, you're pretty lucky, because neither Jake Brigance nor I believe in long speeches. Nor does Judge Attlee, for that matter." There were some smiles. It was almost funny. "I'd like to leave you with my opening thoughts, my first visual for this trial. Think of Seth Hubbard on October 1st of last year, facing certain death and already determined to speed it up, racked with pain and heavily medicated with painkillers. Sad, lonely, single, estranged from his children and grandchildren, a dying, bitter old man who'd given up. And the only person near enough to hear him and console him was Letty Lang. We'll never know how close they really were. We'll never know what went on between them. But we do know the outcome. Ladies and gentlemen,
This is a clear case of a man making a terrible mistake while under the influence of someone after his money.
When Lanier sat down, Judge Atlee said,
"Call your first witness, Mr. Bergantz." The proponents called Sheriff Ozzie Walls.
From the second row, Ozzie hurried to the witness chair and was sworn in. Quince Lundy was seated at the table to Jake's right, and though he had practiced law for almost 40 years, he had aggressively avoided courtrooms. Jake instructed him to glance at the jurors occasionally and make observations. As Ozzie was getting situated, Lundy slid over a note that read, "You were very good. So was Lanier. The jury is split. We're screwed." Thanks, Jake thought. Portia shoved forward a legal pad. On it, her note read, "Frank Doley is pure evil." What a team, Jake thought. All he needed was Lucian whispering bad advice and irritating everyone else in the courtroom. With Jake asking the questions, Ozzie laid out the scene of the suicide. He used 4 large color photographs of Seth Hubbard swinging from the rope. These were passed through the jury box for shock value. Jake had objected to the photos because of their gruesomeness. Lanier had objected to the photos because they might evoke sympathy for Seth. In the end, Judge Atlee said the jury needed to see them. Once they were gathered up and admitted into evidence, Ozzie produced the suicide note Seth left behind on his kitchen table for Calvin Boggs. The note was magnified on a large screen set up across from the jury, and each juror was given a copy. It read, "To Calvin, please inform the authorities I've taken my own life with no help from anyone. On the attached sheet of paper, I have left specific instructions for my funeral and burial. No autopsy. S.H. Dated October 2nd, 1988. Jake produced the originals of the funeral and burial instructions, got them admitted without objection, and displayed them on the big screen. Each juror was handed a copy. They read, "Funeral instructions. I want a simple service at the Irish Road Christian Church on Tuesday, October 4th at 4 p.m., with Reverend Don McElwain presiding. I'd like for Mrs. Nora Baines to sing The Old Rugged Cross. I do not want anyone to attempt a eulogy. Can't imagine anyone wanting to. Other than that, Reverend McElwain can say whatever he wants. 30 minutes max. If any black people wish to attend my funeral, then they are to be admitted. If they are not admitted, then forget the whole service and put me in the ground. My pallbearers are Harvey Moss, Dwayne Thomas, Steve Holland, Billy Bowles, Mike Mills, and Walter Robinson." Burial instructions. "I just bought a plot in the Irish Road Cemetery behind the church. I've spoken with Mr. McGargle at the funeral home, and he's been paid for the casket. No vault. Immediately after the church service, I want a quick interment, 5 minutes max, then lower the casket. So long. See you on the other side. Seth Hubbard." Jake addressed the witness and said, "And Sheriff Walls, this suicide note and these instructions were found by you and your deputies in the home of Seth Hubbard shortly after you found his body, correct?"
"That's right."
"What did you do with them?"
"We took them into our possession, made copies, then the following day gave them to Mr. Hubbard's family at his home."
"I have no further questions, Your Honor."
"Any cross-examination, Mr. Lanier?"
"None."
"You are excused, Sheriff Walls. Thank you. Mr. Bergantz?"
"Yes, Your Honor. At this time, I would like for the jury to be instructed that it has been stipulated by all parties that the documents just admitted into evidence were indeed written by Mr. Seth Hubbard."
"Mr. Lanier?"
"So stipulated, Your Honor."
"Very well.
There is no dispute as to the authorship of these documents. Proceed, Mr. Brigance.
Jake said, "The proponents call Mr. Calvin Boggs." They waited until Calvin was summoned from a witness room. He was a large country boy who had never owned a necktie, and it was obvious he had not even considered buying one for the occasion. He wore a frayed plaid shirt with patches on the elbows, dirty khakis, dirty boots, and looked as though he'd just wandered into the courtroom from a pulpwood cutting expedition. He was thoroughly intimidated and overwhelmed by the surroundings, and within seconds began to choke up as he described his horror at finding his boss hanging from a sycamore tree.
"What time did he call you that Sunday morning?" Jake asked.
"Around 9. Said to meet him at the bridge at 2.
"And you arrived at 2 on the dot, right?"
"Yes, sir, I did."
Jake's plan was to use Boggs to illustrate how Seth took care of the details. He would later argue to the jury that Seth left the note on the table, packed up his rope and ladder, drove to the site, and made sure he was good and dead when Calvin arrived at 2 p.m. He wanted to be found not long after he died. Otherwise, it could have been days. Lanier had nothing to ask. The witness was dismissed.
"Call your next witness, Mr. Brigance," Judge Atlee said.
Jake said, "The proponents call the county coroner, Finn Plunkett." Finn Plunkett was a rural mail carrier when he was first elected county coroner 13 years earlier. At the time, he had no experience in medicine. None was required in Mississippi. He had never visited a crime scene. The fact that the state still elected its county coroners was odd enough. It was one of the last states to do so. Indeed, it was one of the few to ever initiate the ritual to begin with. For the past 13 years, Finn had been called at all hours of the day and night to such locations as nursing homes, hospitals, accident scenes, honky-tonks, rivers and lakes, and homes wrecked by violence. His typical routine was to hover over a corpse and solemnly pronounce, "Yep, he's dead." Then he would speculate on the cause of death and sign a certificate. He had been present when Seth was lowered to the ground. He had said, "Yep, he's dead." Death by hanging, a suicide, asphyxiation, and a broken neck. With Jake leading him through his testimony, he quickly explained to the jury what was already painfully obvious. Wade Lanier had no cross-examination.